Thank you. Can you all hear me? I've also managed to not hook myself up to a microphone. It's slightly better that way for me. But if you can't hear me, I'll do it. I'm actually a writer, a Germanist by background, and I've written about Freud and Nietzsche. And I've always wanted to write about Thomas Mann. Thomas Mann was my first great interest in German literature many years ago. And so this, I'm a writer. This is a paper about a writer, and a writer who I think at some point compared himself with Freud. And what I hope to do is to show you Freud and music seen from the perspective of Thomas Mann, to fill out a picture which does touch on some of the things that have been said this morning, but is not primarily about music. So Thomas Mann's reputation as a writer rests on three or four achievements of slightly different kinds. One was to have achieved the consummate novel of ideas. And in the quarter century after his death, he died in 1955, this view prevailed. The Magic Mountain, you probably know, novel published in 1924, was the work that made the case that Mann was this great novelist of ideas. The second key to his reputation, and it was current at the same time, up to about 30 years ago, was to have built a body of work, fiction and non-fiction, that exposed and resisted, but also tried to explain the 20th century madness that Germany succumbed to. The Magic Mountain, the 1930 short story Mario and the Magician, and the intricate and elaborate 1946 novel Dr. Faustus, with the points of reference. These are the great Thomas Mann works. The third factor in Mann's achievement, as opposed to his reputation, and therefore sometimes overlooked, was, I think, sheer artistic quality, manifest in the early masterpiece Buddenbrooks, a wonderful novel, published in 1901, and the whole body of the short stories, which I think stand in need of rediscovery. In particular, Thomas Mann sympathised with what I'm going to call modest human dysfunction. From the physically disabled to the over-gentle, the defenceless, the passive, and the otherwise psychologically quietly troubled. Sympathy with these human conditions made Mann truly an artist. There's a very early story called Little Herr Friedemann. It's a charming story from 1894, and it set the model. Tony Buddenbrook is drawn with great sympathy, a major character in the Buddenbrook novel of 1901. Little Herr Friedemann, and even more so, a novella called Tonio Kröger, published in 1903, are stories about extreme erotic diffidence and sweetly contained longings, roughly the opposite of Don Giovanni. They contain these longings, this diffidence contains its elements of self-deception, but also great pathos, and the stories explore this pathos as the protagonists envisage themselves as somehow crippled, somehow not quite right, and they find ways of living. Well, we know about this. The stories relate all those self-perceptions and longings and deceptions to their uncertain place in society and bring some realisation of their plight to a head. I don't want to spoil the stories for you. In this slightly unexpected sense, perhaps, given the usual predominance of the great, said to be ironic, novels, Mann's modest fiction tells us something intimate about him. Not necessarily what he intended, I think, the world to understand his message as, but for me, it is the message of this tenderness, of this sympathy with dysfunction. And I stress it here in passing because it was also a word he used indirectly about Freud, and not everybody would call Freud tender and delicate. Thomas Mann wrote of, quote, illness as a means to knowledge. And then in a rather awkward formulation, he goes on to say, he quotes Victor Hugo, "L'humanité," Victor Hugo said, "affirms itself by means of infirmity." And Mann picks up this and he says, "L'humanité is a word that with a proud openness confesses to the tender constitution of all higher humanity and culture, and to its expertise in the sphere of illness. I have to say that Thomas Mann's German is very convoluted and very nuanced and difficult to translate. I'm doing my best. They are actually my translations as we go along. And the fourth factor in Thomas Mann's career was the creation of himself as a public man and also as an integrated self, a project he illustrated with a great deal of first-person and autobiographical writing, letters, diaries, confessions, and appropriate quotations from other writers. He took Goethe as an inspiration and a model, as Freud did, I believe. And latterly, in 1936, it seems to me that he may well have also taken Freud. At least Freud fitted this role in his life. So here I'd like to do three things. To remind you of the various stages in Mann's self-analysis. To suggest how close he came to being Freud's doppelganger. And to look at what Mann meant by music in the context of his self-mastery. So I'll come straight to the music. Mann was deeply musical. He played the violin. However, I risk disappointing those of you whose interest in music is not shaped, as Mann's was, almost entirely by Wagner and Nietzsche and their view of and their role in the German Romantic tradition. That was what Thomas Mann meant by music. Freudians among you may be more interested to learn that part of Mann's uniqueness was to use music, and I've got inverted commas around that, as speaking some force, some power or joy which seemed to dissolve individual separateness, and which before Schopenhauer and Nietzsche and Freud had dared not speak its name philosophically. We heard this morning that it always speaks its name artistically, but philosophically it wasn't really grasped earlier. But I do think Freud had these very important predecessors, which he understandably kept a little bit quiet about: Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, and then Freud. So this music speaks the power of the non-rational over our souls, the power of all that makes us seek out metaphysical and religious experience and artistic experience, and which often manifests itself as something like sexual desire, or has that component in it. In romantic music, as Mann understood it, the instinctive drive for satisfaction surged forth at the cost of social and intellectual order and propriety. It conjured with appetites that could perfectly countenance self-destruction. Music was the promise of satisfaction and delivery welling up from within, an obscure mixture of metaphysics and sexuality with immense emotional and aesthetic power. At the same time, it was necessarily a threat to those who were hanging on to carefully wrought social orderliness by their fingertips. That was very much how Thomas Mann experienced it. The intimacies of romantic music, that's with a capital R, did not strengthen the resolve of those desperately trying not to lose their self-control, and with it, their position in society. So Thomas Mann's self-analysis, well, I think it was very much along the lines that he was a little bit, he was rather sickly. He was rejected for military service and then taken up again and then rejected and then taken up again, but eventually his mother came to rescue him. They were important enough for him to be taken out of military service in 1901. He had this sympathy with illness. I think, as I say, he was quite sickly. He had a sense of the comic. And so those three elements, I think, propelled him into the kind of artist he was going to become. A sense of the comic, in a very sympathetic way, that came out of this sympathy with abnormality, with outsiders, with clumsiness, with debility, with hopelessness, really. That's very much reflected in this early story, Little Herr Friedemann, which is about a young man who's dropped by the nurse in his first weeks of life, and always walks with a limp, and for the first 30 years of his life, he persuades himself that life is fine. And then a woman starts flirting with him. Well, I won't tell you the end. Tonio Kruger, the 1903 novella, is set in Lübeck, where Thomas Mann was born. He was born into a high bourgeois family that put a great deal of emphasis on social form, social correctness, and lived the way Mann saw it, actually a very attractive way of life, because it was so ordered and at the same time rather very, very satisfying in its social relations, quite luxurious, but everything very clear, everybody in their place in the household and in the city. His father was a whole string of relatives that went back through his father. They were very successful merchants in this Hanseatic city. And so Thomas Mann, who wasn't going to become that kind of person, he obviously wasn't going to become a businessman, but he was always divided in his pull towards what he saw as normal, which for him was this business, this commercial environment in which people were not self-conscious, and they weren't intellectual, and they weren't sort of worrying about their inner lives. So he's divided between the pull towards what is perceived as normal and his attraction to things artistic, to music, to philosophy, to ideas that could carry you somewhere that nothing else in life could. The attraction of art, including music, was also as a way out of the world, where the weak person doesn't have a place. And it was reinforced as a temptation to take that way out of the world by reading Schopenhauer. The idea of a retreat from the will, with a capital W, was, you know, one of the great underlying force in the world. The idea of a retreat from the will, which forces participation in the actual world. You get out of this, it's a rather Eastern concept by Schopenhauer, you get out of this by turning your attention and your love to art, to music. You could retreat into a swirl of ideas and emotions that have no external form in the world. And you could also, for Schopenhauer, you could come out the other side of this, because you could actually create art. You could create permanent forms in the name of humanity and culture. As it were, you could hone your will in the direction of the moral. You could pull it out of this swirl of ideas and emotions, and you could give it form, and you could give it a moral significance. Now, this is very much the world in which Thomas Mann created the character of Gustav von Aschenbach, you know, the protagonist of the novella Death in Venice, was published in 1912. But in the case of Gustav von Aschenbach, and you'll remember it if you've seen the Visconti film of 1971 with the music from Mahler's Fifth Symphony, the Adagietta. In the case of Aschenbach, the honing of the will has been pushed too far. It's unnatural, and he can no longer bear it. And we can see that the form this will takes is of an extreme sexual repression. And here is a great man who wages a constant soldierly campaign against himself, and that repression is actually woven into the language if you read it in German. And then suddenly he arrives in Venice, and he falls in love with a boy sitting on the beach, and he's relaxing on holiday, kind of relaxing, and Venice is a strange place after Germany. And then, as you probably remember, cholera arrives in Venice. And all this, his willpower is completely undone, and he doesn't have the will to leave this city where he will contract a fatal disease. So that's the downfall of Gustav von Aschenbach. Well, we know now, and Thomas Mann wanted us to know posthumously, of the intense, lifelong, and only partly repressed homosexual desire that probably more plagued than gratified him through life, though I don't think he would have bothered with the distinction. It was so present in his life, and when you reread the fiction through that perspective, it's absolutely overwhelming. Later, in 1936, Thomas Mann will see, quote, a most mysterious and deep point of contact, unquote, between Schopenhauer's philosophical world and Freud's natural science vision, let's say because of the substrate of desire. Tonio Kruger is often read as a story setting art against life. But against the background of coming to terms with his inner otherness that I've been describing and how he found philosophical and musical ways of talking about it, this story seems to me quintessentially to set oddness against normality and to explore the compensations for oddness, which include art at the highest level, creating art and appreciating art. And when Thomas Mann writes this novella, this semi-autobiographical novella set in Lübeck in 1903, he already knows he can do it. He's an artist. And so that's a fantastic moment, even though he portrays himself as a semi-lost young man, as the author who's standing outside his own autobiographical novella, he knows what he can create. So in 1903, after Buddenbrooks, he's already there, somewhat looking back. I wrote just now that the work Tonio Kruger seems to follow a path of looking at the compensations for oddness that we might pursue, and these would include art at the highest level, creating it and appreciating it. And I think compensation is a difficult word to choose, but as Mann said of himself, and I'm trying to reflect him in what I say here, but as Mann said of himself, he was divided straight down the middle when it came to those great two pulls in life, normality and art. And he took the normality, he found an erotic attraction in normality as well as in art. And it was very, very strong for him, this desire to belong. So that in Tonio Kruger, this complicated boy with a rather Italian look about him, because he's got an Italian mother, is longing to be one of the blonde-haired, blue-eyed Germans who don't think about very much but are very good at sport and that sort of thing. He's longing to be one of them, and he never loses that attraction to normality. So in much of his work, he seems to be talking about ways of fleeing from reality into an inner freedom, where guilt is a private matter, as he writes something on Schopenhauer in 1917. But his eventual reputation is of a writer who took responsibility for his own country. So he's going to go on a very long journey in dealing with this tension inside himself. Mann's self-analysis, and in fact the extraordinary connection he makes between his own inner life and the inner life of cultured Germany as a whole, a life of music and Geist, the life of Kultur, comes to a head in The Reflections of a Non-Political Man, 1918, a long, long book, which defends German inwardness against the liberal civilization of the West. In The Magic Mountain, however, which is only 6 years later, he exposes the futility of the flight into inwardness and the risk of being exploited, as he sees it at the time, by medical quackery. He exposes the futility of that flight for a healthy and normal young man who would do better to serve his country as a soldier. The self-overcoming of The Magic Mountain culminates in the Nobel Prize, she receives in 1929, and in Mann's taking up the role of moral preceptor to the nation and seeing himself, as he saw Goethe actually, as pursuing a national ethos, as embodying it. The German word is Sittlichkeit. Well, that was very important to Thomas Mann. So this is the moment when he begins to associate with Goethe, and I think also with Freud, as public men who have also known the dangers and the seductiveness of romanticism, of inwardness. You might think of I'm terribly attractive, but the rather more wayward Freud of the interpretation of dreams as compared to the Freud of the 1920s and 30s, certainly of the Freud of civilization and its discontents. Now, the many quotes Thomas Mann incorporated from Goethe and a few from Freud into his work helped him rehearse his own intentions and achievements. In 1932, a time of political crisis in Germany and worldwide acclaim for Mann after the Nobel Prize, Mann said of Goethe, "Goethe was the lord and master of the German era of Bildung, whose humane magic, particularly in the case of Goethe, existed in a unique psychological connection of autobiographical self-development and self-fulfillment, connection of that with the idea of education. It existed in such a way that the idea of education forms a bridge and a transition out of the world of personal inwardness into the world of the social." 10 years earlier, Mann had written of Goethe's, as he called it, pathos of renunciation, sein Entsagungspathos, which he said was even more an ethos of renunciation, ein Entsagungsethos. And I suggest this is also how the mature Thomas Mann saw himself, as having renounced something on moral grounds. Not a matter of repression, but a conscious decision to let a certain ego emerge, to displace the id that once lurked. Not to escape into inwardness and solitude, but to take a public role. In his 1936 quote from Freud's from one of Freud's lectures on, in the new lecture series, it's number 31, he picks up a very pithy expression, as Freud had it, "Wo es war, soll ich werden." Very simple. Where the id was, the ego should emerge. You can hear that the German is even simpler. "Wo es war, soll ich werden." In fact, the 1936 essay, Freud and the Future, a salute on Freud's 80th birthday, picked up on what Mann had already keenly argued 7 years earlier in his essay, Freud's Place in Modern Intellectual History. And here already we can see Mann making about Freud some of the adjustments he wanted to make about himself. and I'll give you the German title, Freud's Stellung in der modernen Geistesgeschichte, Mann was keen to point out that although Freud focused on the non-rational and irrational elements in the human makeup, his was a rational project which served the Enlightenment. Mann wrote, quote, "Freud's interest as a researcher in the affective life emerges not as a glorification of his object at the cost of the intellectual sphere. His anti-rationalism means an insight into the actual superiority of instinct in terms of its power over intellect, but it doesn't mean that Freud rolls over before this superiority and despises the power of mind. He gives no cause for these confusions and will not become a victim of anything of the kind. He serves the revolutionary victory of reason and intellect as envisaged for the future." By the way, the word mind there is always in German Geist, which, as you probably know, is that active element in mind. It's somewhat alien to the British conception of mind, I think, which is less lively, less imaginative, but it's very difficult to translate anyway, so I translated it once as intellect and once as mind. But Thomas Mann's point is that Freud stands for the power of mind that's most cultivated, and that although his subject is human non-rationality and irrationality, that's not where he stops. It's part of a project to bring this wider idea of humanity within an ongoing Enlightenment project. And there was a particular reason for doing this in 1929, and it was to attack the irrationalism of Nazi Germany as it was rising up. And he made it very clear in that essay, and it was when the Nazis first got him in their sights, he would be leaving Germany quite soon. Thomas Mann as a writer was similar to Freud in this way. And don't forget that both he and Freud had come through the era of the Bolshevik Revolution and the end of the Habsburg and German empires, and that reason, whatever your politics, was seen as the progressive force. Experiencing firsthand the irrationality of Nazism and the cleverness with which it used such devices as romantic music, capital R, man had learnt what sacrifices had to be made for the cause of reason. For the same reason, and particularly in the climate of Nazism, Wagner left him deeply ambivalent. He wrote, "A passion for Wagner's enchanted oeuvre has been part of my life ever since I first became aware of it and set out to make it my own, to invest it with understanding. What it has given me in terms of enjoyment and instruction I can never forget, nor the hours of deep and solitary happiness amidst the theatre throng, hours filled with frissons and delights for the nerve and the intellect alike, with sudden glimpses into things of profound and moving significance, such as only this art can afford." Yet there was another side, and in this dual perception of Wagner, he was like Nietzsche, who found that Nietzsche was just too finely constituted, nervously constituted, to bear listening to any more Wagner. Yet, so because it unravelled his personality, it unravelled his will to go on living. And as you know, Nietzsche was struggling with illness, and he needed to hold himself together. So. As man had it, there was the other side of Wagner was as follows. The man had so much ability, talent, and interpretive skill, more than words can say, yet so much affection with it, such lordly pretension, self-aggrandizement, and mystagogical self-dramatization. I think Nietzsche also called him a mystagogue. So mystagogical self-dramatization. Again, more than words can say or patience can bear. Between 1929 and 1932, Mann publicly attacked the Nazis in his earlier Freud lecture and on the anniversary of Goethe's death in 1932. He joined a group of European writers voicing their protest against the Nazis in 1932, and his double-edged comments on Wagner were part of the attack. The Nazis retaliated by calling him impudent for his calling Wagner a Philistine. And then he was effectively exiled when Hitler came to power. He was actually out of the country, and his children warned him not to come back. Thomas Mann would henceforth set side by side his thoughts on the dangers and ambiguities of music and the troubling irrationality of the German people. In a passage from 1945, he wrote, "Music is a demonic sphere." This is interesting because we heard this quote almost, in a different context this morning. So this is Thomas Mann now quoting Kierkegaard. He says, "Kierkegaard, a great Christian, showed this compellingly, that music is a demonic sphere, in his painful, enthusiastic essay on Mozart's Don Giovanni. It is Christian art with a negative key signature." Extraordinary formulation. "It is the most carefully calculated order and a chaos-bearing counter-reason at the same time, rich in spellbinding, incantatory gestures, the magic of numbers, the art which is the most distant from reality and the most passionate, the art which is abstract and mystical." From what we were talking about this morning, you would think that Mann was actually summing up quite a lot of what we'd said. Mann went on from that paragraph I've just read out, which was written in 1945, "If Faust be the representative of the German soul, then he must be musical. For abstract and mystical, that is, musical, is the relationship of the Germans to the world, the relationship of a professor with a touch of the demonic, clumsy and at the same time determined by an arrogant consciousness to be superior to the world in all that is deep," with inverted commas. There, of course, was the plot for the 1946 novel Dr. Faustus, finally blaming romantic excess, capital R, romantic, in German music, for the turn to self-destruction, national self-destruction. In fact, Thomas Mann was never quite willing to give up on this German world of artistic, pessimistic, philosophical inwardness, despite the Nazi catastrophe. But he tried to approach it with irony, in some way to make it comic, or as he calls Adrian Leverkühn, the protagonist of Dr. Faust's, clumsy, ungeschickt, unworldly. And what Thomas Mann did was to hold up against the deepness of German Kultur a more worldly standard of European civilization. And in that context, it's always strange to me that Freud's Das Unbehagen in der Kultur should be translated as civilization and its discontent. Because for Freud and Mann, it was very much about Germany. So, problems of translation. So, the encounter with Freud. The point of quoting Goethe and Freud, I'm sure, in Thomas Mann's life and his quest for himself was moderately self-aggrandizing. But it was also a matter of a lifetime of self-contemplation and the attempt at self-mastery. Writing was part of that task, but that writing became guided by the need to make a moral choice. The point of self-discipline was not to conform to a narrower social mores than he would have been comfortable with, although this was always a temptation. As I say, he was very drawn to that life. But the point of self-discipline was to choose a certain life path reflecting from the middle of his life the moral and social good as he could best perceive them. An intense reading of Freud between 1925 and 1929 encouraged that choice of social responsibility. Mann felt that Freud had made a choice too, and that he was like Freud in that balancing out of the romantic and the enlightenment, the irrational and the rational, the inward and the social within himself. When Mann published Freud's Place in Modern Intellectual History in May 1929, Freud reciprocated with what Mann called a magnificent letter in November 1929. And Freud separately subsequently sent Mann a copy of Civilization and Its Discontents, a work that just happened to set forth his Schopenhauerian view of the world as one great appetite. Wishes collide, civilization constrains them, and on the disguised, diverted wish, and on the suspension of real needs, rests the charm of polished society and of art. If civilization and its discontents would have confirmed a view of Freud that man had already formed, what would Freud make of him now, Thomas Mann wondered, as on January the 3rd, 1930, writing from Munich, he got round to reciprocating the redoubled approach from Berggasse the previous autumn. In fact, as the regressions recur, the etiology of the contact between these two men leads us back, like any psychoanalytical investigation, to a beginning that never was. You know, that quote from Freud about the umbilical cord that isn't attached to anything in the end. On Mann's part, it reflected more than two decades of evasiveness since he had written, but subsequently forgotten, what a great effect Freud had on the writing of Death in Venice in 1912. So he forgot, and then he came back to Freud in 1925. And now, in 1930, he would get round to telling Freud that he was now just about ready for personal contact. It must have helped that Mann had just that previous November won the Nobel Prize for Literature, which, though he couldn't know it, Freud himself had coveted. What better could confirm his status as a great man? This could be a meeting of equals. So this is part of the letter that Thomas Mann wrote to Freud. And as I say, his prose is always intricate and it's always insinuating and... Dear Herr Professor, I came to you shamefully late. I am altogether in all respects slow, underlined, by nature. Everything must be extremely ripe within me before I can communicate it. You love the poets, but chiefly, I suppose, as objects for your investigations. With a few boring exceptions, we are all born to that end. Myself in the van, I would say, if it did not sound conceited. It would be good to talk with you about this and kindred themes. Well, you might not quite be sure what's going on there. It seems to me a very flirtatious approach through several degrees of indirectness of language, to say something typical of Mann's style. And the tone, as one of Mann's more recent biographers has labelled it, is certainly faux naive and flirts, I think, with the possibility of a confession, But one has to remember that Thomas Mann was 54, Freud was 73. It's a strange approach. Both the slowness and the ripening suggest a well-defended soul, careful not to reach out to make connections where they're not welcome, and reluctant to open up. In one way, Mann was surely alluding to his denials of Freudian influence on his work hitherto, and his negative portrayal of psychoanalysis in The Magic Mountain. And so perhaps what he's ashamed of is of having resisted the analyst. When Hans Castorf, who's the major figure in Magic Mountain, he resists analysis in that novel, he doesn't want to have his personality unpicked. It is Thomas Mann admitting that he hadn't wanted it in his case either, but now maybe he could meet Freud. Now, perhaps, he wonders with a raised eyebrow. He's learnt that Freud loves poets or writers, Dichter. Somebody else is translating that earlier. It's this word Dichter embraces the idea that art is also, it's about writing, it's painting, it's music. It's difficult in English because when we say art in English, people think of painting, I'm afraid. So, he's learnt that Freud loves poets, Dichter. In fact, the question form makes that love sound a little unlikely and perhaps unwise, faintly comic. You love writers? No, he corrects himself, it's not an erotic urge that brings Freud to make contact. It's purely in the service of his science to take writers as his objects of inquiry. But then again, and this is almost an outburst, I, Thomas Mann, and I've got in brackets here, gay, louche, struggling, somewhat sickly with heart and chest, and an outsider, feel as if I've been waiting all my life to become your object, Herr Professor. That's what I was born for, as he says in his letter. But look, I don't want to push myself forward as someone who must be important to you, or of your stature, given your stature in the world, that would be conceited. Well, you can see there's a great deal of jockeying for power here too. There's a lot of flirtation. And really, if they were going to meet, they should meet as equals. Well, they didn't meet. I think perhaps if they hadn't both been exiled by the Nazis, they might have met. But you know, by the mid-30s, Thomas Mann was in America and Freud was here. So they didn't meet. What Freud had to say privately about Mann's essay, that was the one sent to him in 1929, was that it was very respectful, but it seemed as if Mann already had something ready on Romanticism, and then asked to write about Freud, just tacked it on. Although, Thomas Mann writes is solid stuff. But probably Freud never realised how Mann had identified that disruptive, uncontrollable underlayer in human life that for him was Freud was the unconscious and the dream work, and for Thomas Mann was music. Music which incorporated erotic drives and included the death wish. It was for this reason that Thomas Mann claimed Freud for German Romanticism. Moreover, Mann, more than Freud ever admitted, the pervasive influence over both Thomas Mann and Freud was Schopenhauer and Nietzsche. So that really, when he realised that, he realised they had so much in common. And I don't think he ever would have got that out of Freud directly. No one else did. Conversely, Mann must have readily identified with much that Freud sent him. He didn't. There isn't a comment on record, I don't think. But if he read Das Unbehagen in der Kultur, literally translated as unease, mal à l'aise in French, unease in culture, then he would have known what Freud was talking about. Unease in culture was his inner life. It had always been that way for him as the person he was, and not least the fact that he was gay and he couldn't be publicly married man with six children and so on. I read actually that there was some discussion over how to translate Das Unbehagen in der Kultur into English when it was first translated, and this idea of unease did come up, but it didn't quite hang together. So it has a history there. So there was defensiveness, I think, on both sides, but there were these things that united Freud and Thomas Mann, and apart from their comments on the situation, I would like to mention their sympathetic attitude to their fellow human beings in distress. and the sense of illness as a teacher of humanity. Someone once said that Freud and Thomas Mann have in common a certain true comedy, feeling for true comedy, by virtue of the fact that they're not cultural determinists. They can see that element in us that we don't have control over, which takes control over our lives, that things that happen to us they are actually of our making. I mean, psychoanalysis would explain to us that they are of our making. And for Mann, and I think also for Freud, there was an element of comedy in this. Pitying comedy, sympathetic comedy. Their territory, both of them, is ambiguity, and it amuses both of them. Ambiguity, they play with it, in language. They enjoy finding it in life. I see them as two great men toying with the ambiguities and underlying tensions of civilization, a civilization long premised on the greatness of European humanity and now teetering on the edge of a European cataclysm. Their common theme is sickness, philosophically explored by Schopenhauer and Nietzsche. As Thomas Mann writes in 1928, where there is psychology, there is already also pathology. The world of the soul is the world of sickness. Perhaps the way their convergence most obviously emerges is Thomas Mann's de facto psychoanalysis of German inwardness, of German musicality, as the cause of its monstrous aberrance in the real world. He honours Freud's Enlightenment project as an Enlightenment project after his death in the light of the fact of the war and the Holocaust. Not everyone was ready to appraise Freud in this way. The eminent German scholar of the 1960s and 70s, J.P. Sturm, in his Hitler, the Führer and the People, saw Freud as one of the three wise men, as he sarcastically, ironically called them, of the three wise men leading the Germans astray with their fascination with the non-rational. He wrote that, this is J.P. Sturm now, writes that Freud too believes that men are incapable of freedom and sees the private sphere as identical with the public. You can find that interpretation. It's heavy blame. But Mann saw Freud as, like him, a man deeply shocked by Nazi perversity, if, unlike Mann, unable to do anything about it. The extent to which the thesis of the excess of German inwardness leading to national catastrophe, which was a psychoanalysis of the nation, became convincing during and after the war, the extent to which that the psychoanalysis of the nation as being a really good explanation of what had happened to Germany, that became very convincing, I think, during and after the war. I think it would take a separate investigation, certainly more than I can manage here, to see if it really was an explanation. I somehow have my doubts. But I was struck, I came across this a few years ago, I was struck by a regulation imposed upon the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra in 1946 by the British occupying authorities. This great orchestra, which we now fall over ourselves to praise, was then only allowed to play, quote, light music, unquote. Such was the power of its musical art, its power to enchant the Germans and lead them astray. And we obviously took that, we took that to heart at the highest level of government and military occupation. I don't know when it was lifted. I think it would be worth a little piece of research to find that out. Another tangential consideration of what a collaboration between Mann and Freud together had given us, although that collaboration was never actual, is the question of how much ground the composition of music and a private love of it share with neurosis, precisely because of the degree of ordering that goes into composition, coupled with the sense of reaching out towards religious or mystical truth, which is to say music requires inwardness and discipline, and that comes at a cost to the balanced personality. For private listeners to cultivate it intently may also take the form of a neurosis. And this, I think, is what Anthony Storr, who was mentioned this morning, explores in his book of 1992, Music and the Mind. So Mann understood this problematic, what's German say, problematic that surrounded romantic music, that it could at once glorify our human existence, put us in touch with beauty and mystical intensity, at the same time as quietly reinforcing neuroses and providing surrogate comforts. Freud, evidently the cooler of the two men, the more theoretical and self-confessedly deaf to music's charms, nevertheless had a concept of metapsychology which he formed while studying the case of Dr. Schreber and writing his version down of it in 1910-1911. And metapsychology said that states of mind alone lie at the roots of philosophies, religions, and myths, and psychoneuroses are thus in their origins and projections close, if aberrant, relations of great cultural achievements. So I think we would want to include great music in with those philosophies, religions, and myths. Mann wrote in his Schopenhauer essay, it's a quote, "Art, knowledge, and the dignity of human suffering are here envisaged as one." And he, another sentence about Schopenhauer, "Desire is a form of pain." I think that exactly expresses what these two men, Mann and Freud, knew. But this isn't Mann as Freud's doppelganger, it's actually Mann the musician leading the way. Mann was acutely sensitive to the fact that music reminds us of abstract and mystical truths as no other art form can, although in the end, I wonder if Freud saw them as truths. Freud was, as you know, deeply sceptical about metaphysical claims. I don't know about Thomas Mann. I think he probably held on to them. Thomas Mann died in 1955. But my conclusion today is that there was some coalescence of Thomas Mann and Freud, particularly in this period after the war when Mann came into his own and when he could say something like art, knowledge, and the dignity of human suffering are here envisaged as one. It seems as if he could see that his project and Freud's were very closely related. Just as a sort of to finish inappropriately in a minor key, but I'd just like to amplify what Thomas Mann obviously felt about that he would have made a good patient for Freud because of that lifelong burden of secrecy, because of his homosexuality, and the feeling that at some level all his writing about the freedoms and temptations of music and philosophical inwardness might one day be seen predominantly in that light. And I think it's a great pity if we're tempted to do that, but it does, of course, prompt a rereading. In the diaries which he always wanted to see published posthumously, the great Thomas Mann, this moral preceptor, this national leader, this great figure, Thomas Mann, who had rescued what was left of the dignity of the condemned German nation, confessed to desiring his own son, Klaus. Subsequently, his story has come to include the tale of the whole family. With his wife, Katja Mann, he had 6 children, in order of seniority, Erika, Klaus, Golo, Monika, Elisabeth, and Michael. As this now adult family settled in exile in America, the final wartime resting point of their flight from Hitler, it was said that all they ever talked about was homosexuality. Mann's children were talented, gay, and disturbed. Erika, Klaus, and Golo were all gay, or mostly so. It's said that Erika made an exception for Bruno Walter. Who wouldn't have made an exception for Bruno Walter? So Golo, perhaps the only one who achieved a degree of self-correction that gave him a purchase in life, wrote a sober history of Germany that was not, unlike his father's versions, a history of romanticism with himself as its last great figure. Mann's second son, Klaus, made the film Mephisto, surely also a comment on his father's career, and then, addicted to cocaine, killed himself. Michael made a career as a professor of German literature before ending up another suicide. Incest was another family trait. Stories existed about Erika and Klaus and their own mother, Katja, and her brother, Klaus. The Mann family seems to have been devastated over 2 generations by inappropriate sexual longings in a bourgeois society. And what else can we say except that Mann's suspicions were right? Freud would, in a sense, have been waiting for him. I think we also know that Freud could better have written up each of these cases individually than done anything to alleviate the courses the lives of the Mann family took. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Leslie. Yes, I should have interrupted you. Maybe went on a bit longer than expected, but it was so fascinating that I couldn't possibly stop you. Just a small similarity between another one between Thomas Mann and Sigmund Freud. Sigmund Freud also had six children, although none of them ended in suicide. So I hope we can just open the discussion and see if anybody has some either question or comments to make on Thomas Mann, Sigmund Freud, Wagner, and anyway, the German culture of the time was so clearly, I think Thomas Mann was a major exponent of what German culture was in those years, and the fact that he was so powerfully, as Leslie has clarified to us, influenced also by Freudian ideas, is of great interest to us, of course. There is a gentleman over there. And again, tell us your name.
Thank you very much indeed. I'm glad you got to the children. I mean, they came almost as an afterthought, but it's important, isn't it? I mean, sitting here in this building, when we think about children, and the children are great men, and there is a sense I felt, in a way, that actually man wasn't really able to contain his ambiguities within himself, and that it did tragically spill over for the next generation. And much as the relationship between Freud and his daughter, perhaps other children, is very questioned, nonetheless, none of them took their lives. And I think there was a third one, wasn't there, as well? I mean, in the man's family, who committed suicide?
Erika, Klaus, and Michael.
Right, yeah. So,
it's a lot. It's terrible.
Yes.
It's
I just wondered in a way.
I wasn't glorifying it anywhere.
No, I didn't mean that you were, but it's interesting. Yeah. I just felt in a way that there's so much unfinished business of his life that the children have to pick up the pieces of.
Was he still alive, Thomas, when the children committed suicide?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know that. I think he would have been alive in one case. Yes. Yes, I think he was, there are terrible stories about him being an ordinary kind of father, let alone what else he passed on. But it's not all culture, is it? It's not all come from his behaviour in the family. Some of these things are passed on in ways that we just can't control. I mean, after all, if his wife had an incestuous relationship with her brother, that's also problematic for the children. I'm not an expert on how you would expect these things to be reproduced in the next generation or not. But if it's true that they were sitting around talking about being gay all the time, always as a family, it can't have been a very healthy, normal kind of atmosphere. I've not read anything else like it. I just think it's a case. It would be a series of literary cases for Freud to write up and to say, well, yes, we can only sympathise. They were all terribly clever, of course, immensely clever. Yes, but I mean, someone's got to be clever. Someone's got to be clever, and someone's got to be artistic, and they were that. So let's not. I'm quite in favour of resisting the pressures of the normal. I mean, perhaps not that far, but it hasn't quite afflicted me like that.
And Thomas Mann described in the Buddha group a very dysfunctional family.
Yes.
And through generations.
Yes. Well, it was. But in a way, I mean, that might have been. It wasn't Schopenhauer's father a businessman. It's about how the intellectual and artistic element comes into a family and saps the will to go out there and be a businessman in the world. And we've all come across changes of generation like that. But Thomas Mann dramatised it through this reading of reading of Schopenhauer and listening to Wagner, in the end, you know, the great-great-grandchildren just can't get out of bed. I mean, they were just so weak and so consumed by this Wagnerian spirit of darkness and sickness, whereas their great-grandfather was a sort of leading public figure in North German life. So he felt that about himself. I mean, that he'd been born into this family, and what was he? He was a gay writer who didn't obviously have a place. So
I think we have time for another couple of questions. Gentlemen, go over there.
I'm just wondering whether you could re-quote the sentence, art, knowledge, and the dignity of human suffering. Could you finish that? Could you?
Right. I'll have to find it. Yes. Shall I take another question while I'm looking for it?
Yes, please, the gentleman over there.
Do you know whether man had any particular views about Beethoven's part in his man's German culture, German English?
I'm sure he did, but I can't tell you. I would have thought that he would think that Beethoven was kind of hero like Goethe, because it was, yes, I don't think Beethoven is assailable. He was just a humanist, giant. So I, if I were going to look for Thomas Mann's references to Beethoven, I wouldn't expect to find these descriptions of ambiguity and death wish, and even though he counts as a romantic. The quote from Thomas Mann's essay on Schopenhauer. And I've even got a page reference, so there's Thomas Mann Essays from Three Decades, page 402. Art, knowledge, and the dignity of human suffering are here envisaged as one.
Mine is just a quick thought that links back to the morning. Am I right?
So I don't know where I'm looking.
So here.
Oh, yeah.
Am I right in remembering that the composer figure of Dr. Faustus is thought to be based on Schoenberg?
Yes, Adrian Leverkühn. But his name, Leverkühn, means to live dangerously, which is a Karl Nietzsche's, live dangerously. So he's a composite figure. And I think Bruno Walter had a lot advised Thomas Mann on the novel. I think so, and that's how Eric got
it. Yes. And of course, Bruno Walter met Freud.
Yes.
So yes. Very interesting. There is some literature about what actually happened.
As far as I know, there's not a lot on Freud and Thomas Mann, is there?
No,
not really. No, it's really curious. Yes. Thanks very much.
Okay. Stop here. We resume maybe. Shall we give it until 1:45? Is that you're right? Or is that late?
Thank you very much.